You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. On April 28th, the protests in Fallujah, Iraq, turned violent when the U.S. military fired on Iraqi protesters, leaving 17 dead and at least 70 wounded. The military's version of what took place that day differs widely from that of groups such as Human Rights Watch, which investigated the incident. Under international humanitarian law, as an occupying force, the U.S. is required to ensure public order and safety in Iraq. Mark Garlasco, a senior military analyst for the group, spoke with Peace Watch earlier today about some of the ballistic evidence found at the school where the shootings occurred.
Looking at the scene, you find that across the street from the school, you have multiple small caliber weapon impacts from what appear to be 5.56 millimeter and 7.62 millimeter shells, which are the standard rounds that the U.S. military uses. On the school itself, the soldiers were carrying M4 carbines, and they had the M249 squad automatic weapon light machine gun. They also had the M60 machine gun. Now, the U.S. weapons use steel core penetrators, and so you'll find that across the street from the school, the houses have large gaping holes in them from where the small arms went in. You've got cinder blocks, basically, that have been pierced straight through. And there was also a car there that had been pretty riddled by bullets, and we were able to pull out the steel core for one of the 5.56 millimeter rounds. Now, when you look at the school itself, you really don't see that kind of ballistic evidence. There's some pockmarking, which may be representative of basically a soft-tip lead bullet. We can't really determine what kind of round the Iraqis were firing, although the U.S. states that they were AK-47s. If they were and they were shooting soft-tip lead, it is perhaps all you're going to see is some removal of paint. But really all that we could find were a few small pockmarks, nothing that would reflect a large-scale attack or a coordinated attack on U.S. forces.
So what can we conclude from your munitions findings as in terms of what happened there, who was shooting what at whom?
Well, it's without a doubt that the U.S. was shooting at someone in the crowd. Obviously, we have civilian deaths incurred, and we have ballistic evidence of the U.S. firing at the Iraqis. What's not so clear is who was firing or if there was actual firing at the U.S. The U.S. military said they received effective fire. I saw no evidence of effective fire on their positions. In fact, when you go into the rooms where the U.S. were operating from, we could find absolutely no bullet impacts at all. So the question then becomes, were the U.S. being fired upon, or was it just rock throwing?
Well, that's a pretty serious conclusion. Or even to raise that as a question, are we talking about a similar situation to what we're seeing often in Gaza, where the Palestinians are throwing rocks and the Israelis are using bombs?
Well, certainly we don't see any bomb use here in Fallujah. We're requesting an investigation by the U.S. military at this point because the ballistic evidence that we see is inconclusive, but we do have civilian casualties incurred. It's then, we believe, up to the United States military to go there. And if they are so certain, so very certain, that they were receiving effective fire, then we believe it's time for them to come forward and prove it.
So would it be fair to say that the Iraqi people were throwing rocks while the U.S. military was returning with gunfire, with bullets?
Well, it's possible, but don't forget it's also possible that there were some Iraqi shooters. As we put in our report, there may have been some provocateurs, perhaps onesies and twosies firing at the U.S., and you have people who are in a situation where the town is basically very hostile to U.S. troops, and it's possible that you had some U.S. forces that were a little bit nervous at that situation. And if they were receiving fire, whether it was effective or not, it would be understandable that they would fire back. The question is then, if they did fire back, were they firing back at the perpetrators, or was it a little bit more sporadic and not as directed as they said that it was?
And it's probably difficult for the U.S. military to distinguish between ordinary citizens and military fighters, is it not?
Certainly it is, but we also have to remember at the night of the shooting, the U.S. was wearing night vision goggles, and the Iraqi civilians in the crowd did not have anything which they could use to determine who they were firing at, if they were firing at anyone. And so we would hope that having the technological advantage, the U.S. military would be able to take a look, identify exactly who was shooting at them, if anyone, and then return fire to those areas. When you look at the street, in fact, the entire street up and down has been riddled with bullets along the houses. Now, it is directed in certain clumps and areas, but it's a rather large and wide expanse. And if U.S. forces were receiving effective fire from only certain areas, it appears to be a rather wide area to be shooting at. They said that there were snipers on the roofs of the houses and that there were folks within the crowd firing at them. What's not clear is what kind of weaponry or what if any, were being fired at them. The next day when the U.S. military went around and tried to do a weapons search, they came up with a number of small arms. But when you speak to the people there, they say that these weapons are there for their own protection and that they were not involved in shooting at the U.S.
So the discrepancy over whether there was effective fire or not, is that the only way in which your investigation differs from the account of the U.S. military?
Well, we still don't have any proof that there was fire against the U.S. military. What we're saying is it's possible that there was fire, but we can see no evidence of any firing, or effective fire at least. And so, therefore, we're requesting that the U.S. military performs an official investigation.
Have they agreed to do this?
Not at this time.
Given the turmoil and political unrest felt by, I think it's fair to say, many Iraqis living under the U.S. occupation forces, what can be done, in your opinion, to stop protests from becoming violent?
Well, first and foremost, the United States has to communicate better with the Iraqi people. It's very interesting. Over a five-week period that I was in Iraq, I would come upon many Iraqis who would tell me that the United States is just not living up to its side of the bargain. Just basic services are not being worked on, for example, replacing electric power. And in fact, I know from being in daily meetings with the U.S. military over in Iraq that they're working very hard and fast to get return some of these basic services like electric power. But because of a lack of communication, some of the Iraqis are getting violent. Not only that, but there needs to be some discussion with the local imams, speaking with the clerics, so that at the grassroots level, if there is some kind of a problem with the population, and if they find that there's going to be something directed against U.S. forces, that perhaps at a lower level we can curtail these things before they grow and boil up into an international incident that leads to deaths.
Are there enough Iraqis working with the U.S. administration in place there to try and facilitate some communication?
I really can't speak to the Iraqis working to help communicate with the U.S. One thing I can say is that when we did speak to public affairs officers in Baghdad and asked them why they're not being more proactive in going out and speaking to the Iraqi population, they told us that, in fact, it was incumbent upon the Iraqis themselves to be speaking to their own population. And we stated that, well, if you're not telling them what you're doing, how can they tell their own people what they're doing? And so we believe that really the United States should be doing a better job communicating its position.
Do you anticipate more incidents of this sort happening as the U.S. occupation continues?
Well, it's certainly possible, and we've seen lately that the U.S. has been going out more and more in the Fallujah and areas north of Baghdad to crack down on what they state are Iraqi militants working against U.S. forces. And so if this continues, there certainly is the possibility of growing tension between the Iraqis and the U.S. When I was in Baghdad, power, for example, was on a rolling blackout status, and you really only had to power about 2 to 4 hours a day. Now, that was 2 weeks ago, and I'm certain that by this time things are a little bit better. But still, people need to have their basic services, otherwise they are going to be rather upset.
Mark Garlasco, Senior Military Analyst for Human Rights Watch. The ascendancy of the United States to the position of the sole superpower in the world has been one of the longest projects of the past 100 years. The invasion of Iraq is the latest in a long line of military actions that Tariq Ali, Pakistani exile, political commentator, and author, called The Exercise of Empire. Ali recently spoke at the University of California about the rise of the U.S. as an empire. Yesterday on Peace Watch, Ali asserted that in order to understand how the U.S. has evolved to its present status, we must look to the history. In part two of his speech today, Ali begins with World War I and how the U.S. came to be involved.
The purpose of that intervention was to try and sort out the world as the United States grew into maturity as a gigantic capitalist state with enormous resources. And these resources were then used in their own interests, but not simply in their own interests. And this is what makes the American Empire a very interesting object of study, that they decided basically to take the leadership of the capitalist world. After 1945, the big threat perceived by the empire was a wave of revolutions. They had to do a deal with Stalin to stop them, and the deal was done for Europe. But in Asia, in Latin America, deals couldn't be done because there was no one to totally control that situation. So you had a wave of revolutions. In Latin America, it ended with the seizure of power in Havana by Che Guevara and Fidel Castro in 59 with their ragtag army. And they did it because no one was expecting it. No one was prepared for it. But if the question is asked, why did the United States then, through the Marshall Plan and other means indirectly, rebuild the fallen capitalisms of Europe and Japan? The answer is because they saw another enemy. They were strategically, it was quite a visionary thing to do. It wasn't even in their own interests to do that, because ultimately they were building rival capitalisms. But they did it because they saw the dangers that lay ahead if they didn't. So Japan and Germany were rebuilt. And the reason they were rebuilt was to participate in the battles that lay ahead. And the reason I say this is because those times have now changed and gone forever. And that is why we're in a new situation, where, if you like, on one level, we're in a pre-1917 situation again, where different capitalist states are beginning to jostle for space, for markets, for where you have the great American empire now worried not by a threat of revolution from the left, but worried essentially by its current rivals and potential rivals in Europe and the Far East. That is what determines and dominates the thinking of many of the neoconservatives who surround Bush. And let me tell you this. You know, we all joke about Bush. I mean, often you can just go to a meeting and say, Bush. There you go. You see, I knew this. And one's got to be a bit counterintuitive here, that under Reagan, a counter-revolution began, which started in Managua and ended in Moscow. So he may have been a B-movie actor, he may have been playing a part, but the people around him weren't so dumb. And they reflected and pushed forward the interests of the empire. After all, the defeat of that system didn't upset me too much, but in terms of a big triumph for the West and Western capitalism, it was pretty phenomenal. So actually, Reagan will probably be marked as the guy who started that whole thing off. Now, Bush and the people surround Bush may not be bright. In fact, once I remember during the election campaign, he was asked, you know, your knowledge of the rest of the world is not very profound. And he said, that's true, but, you know, people around me know. Actually, it was quite honest. And it's absolutely true. They do. So these neoconservatives who've been mocked and attacked, as they should be, shouldn't be mocked and attacked for the wrong reasons. From their point of view, they're trying to shore up the empire against all potential enemies and potential threats. And this means strong military budgets, militarization, whatever it entails, we have to do it. This was the argument taken up by the neocons in the Project for the 21st Century, which is now part of the official strategy doctrine of the Bush regime. But they aren't doing it for themselves. And however tempting it is to think of them as a narrow clique, in a sense they are pretty audacious and bold defenders of the American empire. And the fact that they are doing it unilaterally doesn't make much of a difference as far as they're concerned, nor should it as far as we're concerned. I get fed up of this argument, as if somehow the war against Iraq would have been morally justified if it had been supported by the Security Council. It's great the French resisted, don't get me wrong. And, you know, even despite the fact you now have to call a French kiss a liberty kiss in this country, but despite that, it's very good what they did, and it's even better what the Germans did when they spoke up against the war before it began. But once it began, They backed it. They wished the best of luck to the United States. They didn't stop French airspace being used. The Germans didn't stop the U.S. bases in Germany being used. And when people say, how could they? I say, well, they've done it in the past. De Gaulle did it. Pulled France out of NATO. Refused to back the Vietnam War. Not a single European country backed the war in Vietnam. The people who fought with the United States were a handful of South Koreans and Australians to give the cover of an alliance. So it's not that this hasn't happened before. It's just the Europeans didn't back it before, and in fact many resisted it, including the British government at the time, which was under very heavy pressure to send troops, refused to do so. So it's not that it can't be done. It's just that they didn't choose to do so this time. And the reason they didn't choose to do so brings us to a central feature of contemporary politics, which is that the United States empire is on its own. It has never happened before. We have not had a situation where a single empire has dominated the globe. So that it was not the case in the past. It is the case today. And this is what makes the situation globally quite unstable whenever the empire decides to go on an offensive and expand its influence, the world gets very edgy. And that is what makes the Europeans very nervous, but at the same time makes them very weak, that they don't know what to do, they don't know how to resist, or let's put it bluntly, they're scared to resist the empire. And they half loathe Tony Blair for doing what he did, and half of them admires him. The image you have of Blair constantly is a sort of bloodshot adjutant of the empire, actually liking it. You know, not just a passive poodle, someone who wants to go, you know, straining at the leash. Let me go, let me be the first. If you just look at the budget, $400 billion a year is the military budget of the United States. The country which comes closest to it is China on $40 billion. I mean, the rest you can add up, and still it doesn't quite add up to the U.S. military budget. Now, in this situation, what countries, even small countries, attempted to do, which is extremely dangerous for them, for the people who live there, are to think that the only way they can save themselves is by going nuclear. Because everyone knew, incidentally, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This was not a big secret. Unfortunately, many people here believed it, as they believed that there were also links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, which was also treated as a joke everywhere else in the world. But here it was taken seriously.
Political commentator and author Tariq Ali, speaking at the University of California. Special thanks to Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio for production assistance with that piece. At various times of his life, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has been a pilot, a businessman, a congressman, and an ambassador. Hart Seeley, writer and columnist with the Syracuse Post-Standard, recently published a book about Rumsfeld, which highlights one of the defense secretary's lesser-known career paths. Peace Watch spoke with Seeley today and asked what he had learned about Rumsfeld from research for his book.
I'm not sure whether Mr. Rumsfeld himself ever realized that he has a poetic side to him, but I was listening to his deviations from the norm when he was addressing the press during the Iraqi war, and I just decided that if you put those things into the form of verse and looked at them very carefully, you could find some poems in those words. And so I set out to do that, and that's what this book is all about, the poetic side of Donald Rumsfeld.
Does the press corps know he's a poet?
Well, you see, I don't think we reporters in this world are fully into that kind of sensibility. I think most reporters are geared more toward prose. And, you know, I'm a newspaper reporter. Most people think newspaper reporters are geared towards bad prose. So I like to think that Rumsfeld's words would have always been floating over the heads of most of the reporters in the Washington Assembled Press Corps. But somehow he managed to connect with me through the television set and everything along those lines.
Hmm. Can you give us a few examples of Rumsfeld's eloquent poetry?
Well, I'd be happy to. They run the gamut. He has a few haiku. He has some Zen-like views. And he also has a sort of a push and pull mentality that I think draws some extreme knowledgeable conclusions about life. And I'll give you an example. This one's entitled On Walking Towards a Wall. Now, he said this on June 24th, 2002, in an interview with Bloomberg News. And it's all transcribed on the White House websites, which put all these things down. You have to imagine that here he's talking to reporters, and he deviates from whatever question it was that they had asked, and he says this poem, On Walking Towards a Wall. If you're walking towards a wall, and you decide you want to go to the opposite wall, the sooner you make the correction, the easier it is. If you wait until your right face up against the wall, then you've got to make a sharp turn. I'm not sure if the poet is really referring to a wall. A lot of times poets speak to us in the form of allegory and metaphor, and I think it's up to every reader to determine what poet was meaning when he wrote that.
Well, yeah, I was a little unclear. Is it profound? I mean, is there something there that I'm sort of missing? Is there profundity embedded here?
Well, I think it's possible. There's something embedded there, and we may have to someday get the poet himself to explain it. But you know, some of the great works of art are never fully explained. Can I give you another example?
Please do.
Well, now, you know, one of the elements to the Rumsfeld poetic universe is an occasional rhyme poem. So, you know, in upstate New York, we're a simplistic breed, and basically, I think most people think if a poem doesn't rhyme, it's not really a poem. Yeah. And I found a poem that rhymes, and it was spoken by Rumsfeld on April 26, 2002, when he was meeting with the troops overseas. And it's entitled Flying To, and it goes as follows. Now, that is not always true. Think of the B-52. It's still flying just fine, thank you, and so am I. Thank you. Now, those were exactly his words. I don't know whether he really knew that he was composing a rhyme at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, initially I thought maybe this is haiku, but then again, he's not Japanese.
Well, no, no, he's not. But he does have a few haiku in this book. He moves across the board on almost every level, from the rhyme poetry to some pretty funky rhythms. But he has some, I think, wonderful haiku. This one was spoken December 3rd, 2002 in a news briefing for the DOD. And it's entitled Evasion Haiku. And it goes as follows. I'm working my way over to figuring out how I won't answer. Now that has a definite Zen aspect to it. Because if you break it down to its components, although I understand that to dissect art is a bad idea, and you never can keep something alive if you dissect it. But if for a moment we deviate, and we do break that down, he's working his way over to figure out how he won't answer.
Do the reporters allow him to just wax poetic like this without coming back and saying, what did you say?
Well,
and what did you mean by what you said?
Well, I think in many respects they do, and sometimes they don't. I think that for the most part, when reporters hear someone going off on a tangent like this, the sounds of pens clicking off is the sound that would most be what you'd apply to it. I mean, I'm a reporter, and I've been in many different news conferences where somebody suddenly gets off the beaten track, and you realize there's nothing you're going to be able to use of what they're saying right now. So your tendency is to shut off and wait for the next opportunity to ask an actual relevant question.
And you write in Slate magazine that Rumsfeld's poetry is paradoxical and often evasive, confusing, yet entrancing. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, you know, he goes into a lot of different directions all at once. Can I give you an example? Perhaps the most famous of the Rumsfeldian poems thus far is one that's called The Unknown. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know, but there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Now, I'd like to think in my life that this book represents to Rumsfeld an unknown, unknown, unknown.
Yes.
I took it one step further, I believe.
Very Cat in the Hat-like, too, I would say, in some sense.
There is a little of that, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. In fact, it's through his poetry that, of sorts, that Rumsfeld addresses some of the most serious and somber subjects affecting us today.
Well, very much. There's some elements to this that are extremely political. I don't think you can ever do a poem book or anything about a fellow like Rumsfeld without getting into some political notions. And his writing, for example, about the economy of oil is very profound. And some of these poems erupt straight out of the memory hole. They relate to questions about weapons of mass destruction and debates that were held and in some degrees no longer seem to be as relevant as they might have seemed at the time. This is a poem called The Economy of Oil, and it goes as follows. If a bad person owns the oil, and a good person owns the oil, different oil, and the bad person doesn't want to sell it to you, but the good person is willing to, it doesn't matter, because then the good person sells it to you. You're not going to be buying this person's oil, but this person's going to be selling it to somebody else, and the world price will be the same. Everyone will have the oil they need. They aren't going to hoard it. They're not going to keep it in the ground. They need the money from the oil, so it's not a problem. Now, I think Americans will be comforted by the notion that he said that to Al Jazeera in response to questions about a possible oil boycott in February of 2003. And I wonder how that translated into Arabic. I hope it maintained its poetic integrity.
Yes, indeed. And so Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his vast poetic talents, is he the only Secretary of Defense to be so endowed with this type of talent?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I would think that some of the others back down the road might have ventured into the realm of poetry. I know Jimmy Carter attempted to write poems. I attempted to get some poetry out of the White House spokesperson, Ari Fleischer, and completely failed. I think, to be honest with you, Fleischer was attempting to do poetry when, after the original Rumsfeld poems were published, I think Fleischer attempted to do poetry, and it was pathetic. However, I have thought about trying to get some cocktail napkin doodlings from Fleischer with the idea that we might have a coffee table book.
His doodlings and Rumsfeld's ramblings?
Something along those lines. You know, picture books with poetry, multimedia is the way to go these days. You know, if we could get that kind of thing going, we're talking coffee mugs, mouse pads, we're talking tote bags, we're talking a cottage industry.
Well, has Rumsfeld thanked you for culling his talents together in one book? The Pieces of Intelligence, the existential poetry of Donald Rumsfeld?
No, he hasn't said a word. The official response from the Department of Defense has been no comment.
That's probably an unknown unknown.
It could be an unknown unknown,
mm-hmm.
Or a no comment unknown.
I'm not sure. There's probably a it'll never be known poem to be written.
Well, you know, it's possible that the best poetry is yet to come. Sometimes these poets, when they start out, have a lot of evolving to do. Rumsfeld starts into this at a relatively ripe age in his life, but I still think that there's room for improvement, and as his facilitator, I'm just hoping that I can be along for the ride.
Hart Seeley, journalist for the Syracuse Post-Standard and author of Pieces of Intelligence, the Existential Poetry of Donald H. Rumsfeld. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T. from the Pattersons. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Venta Berkland, Keith Shaljian, and OneWorldRadio.net. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.